so what we're doing now is we're looking at a couple of key questions here. So if the northeast attribute represents the quiet mind, and if I explain to you that the quiet mind, for the context of sort of thinking about it in modern times, what does this quiet mind thing mean? It's mindfulness coupled with sensory integration. Like, all senses have been activated. All of them are like muscles that are back in shape and developed. So they're all out there. They're working. And they're all flowing back into the system. And that we have the ability to tap into our senses in a way that causes us to go into inner silence. And in that inner silence, there's like this profound communication through our senses with everything around us. Right? So this is the quiet mind. The quiet mind is one of the most useful things about deep nature connection. And I, you know, everyone has told me this in so many different ways and words over the years, is I've interviewed people about what are the benefits of nature connection. Everyone talks about this sense of inner peace that they get from it and how that helps them in their life. Well, one of my favorite stories was this one man who told me that he stopped going to his sit spot and he hadn't been there for a number of years. And I asked him why, and he started to tell me all the things in his sit spot experience, that benefits that came back to his life. He was more creative. He said it increased time in his life. It didn't take time away. And I said, can you please explain that for me? He said, yeah. He said, you know, it's like when you think about going to your sit spot, but then you start telling yourself that you have this whole list of things to do and you're too busy and you don't have the time to go out and sit for 10 or 20 minutes outside and do nothing, because the whole time you're out there, you're just thinking about what's on your list. He says, but then when you get out to your sit spot and you engage your senses in that full way, the list evaporates because you realize that you sort of generated the list from this place of anxiety in your head, and these weren't things that you really needed to do in the first place, but they end up on your list anyway. So he said, the strange thing about going out and having nature connection was that it made me less busy, not more busy. It didn't take away from my busy life. It actually added more time to it. And this is all rooted in the quiet mind. And he basically talked himself back into going to his sit spot again from extolling the virtues of this. And because I think the quiet mind is the ultimate goal for us when we use that as the primary thing that we work with young people to get them to that quiet mind, all the other attributes turn on much more quickly, because we call it the keystone attribute for that reason. So I've been thinking about it from the standpoint of, if I could visualize as if my body is like a robot, and somewhere inside this robot there's like a little control room, right? You open the door and you go inside and then you sit down, there's a console. And there's like all these panels and all these buttons and switches that somebody's sitting in the chair operating the robot, which is me. You know, I said, if there is such a place, what is the regulator of the whole system? Like, who is the person sitting in the chair that's regulating the whole thing so that it works? And I started to use the metaphor that every sensory system has a terminal in that room. So like everything that's coming in through the ears has one screen. Everything coming in through the eyes has a different screen. In fact, there's two screens for the eyes, because there's what the center of your eyes deliver and then what your peripheral vision delivers. And they really need two different screens because they function really differently. So you got those three screens. And then you've got the screens of your tactile information, and you've got the screens from your proprioception, how the body feels itself in space, you know, and the vestibular, the relationship of all the different parts of ourself working together in concert, you know, and then we've got our sense of smell, our sense of taste, and there's all these other subtle senses that all come together, and they all come pouring into the control room with different screens. If a person is connected to nature in the way that we're hardwired to, when input's coming in, all the screens make sense together as one image. They all make sense. They integrate and tell one story. So let me give you an example. We hear a jay make a sound, right? We hear that. this part of our nervous system, the nerve bed in the pit of our stomach, feels it like someone's doing this on our stomach, but pulling on our stomach muscles right in our diaphragm every time the jay makes a noise. When we look at the jay, its beak is pointing down and it's bobbing its head with every sound. So when you look at the screen, all those things integrate and they tell one story. And the synthesis of all that information is a communication. The jay is upset about something. I should look. And when I look, I see that there's a bobcat hiding just out of view, and the jay is scolding it, right? That's an integrated sensory experience. And some of the things that are being pointed out by modern researchers, which are fairly troubling, what if one screen is putting in information from the visual that was created from a person's ideas and became a media piece, right? A game or something on the internet, right? And the sound came from a different person, which was a soundtrack generated that really is sort of random and electronic sounding, and those two screens aren't matching up. And the person sitting in the chair in the control room now doesn't know what to do with these signals that are coming in. The activities that are being demonstrated don't match either. Some of them are kind of violent or showing violence, and it makes the body feel a little weird, and the body doesn't know what to do with it. So there's like all this errant information that doesn't integrate. And do you understand what a problem that is for the nervous system? The brain doesn't know what to do with that. And so they're actually saying that now modern people, their brains are literally changing shape. Like the way the two hemispheres are communicating with each other isn't working the same as it used to. We're literally kind of putting in errant input into the system, and there's nothing integrating at the center. This is where a lot of what are loosely called just nature deficit disorder issues or sensory process disorder issues are becoming epidemic in modern times. Obviously, everything we're talking about from the standpoint of pulling in integrated sensory information that makes sense within a larger framework is what we're craving, what we're longing for, what the nervous system needs to be healthy. Does that make sense? So the sound of the jay, the feeling of the jay, the view of the jay, the nervous system, the gut feeling about the jay, the body feeling like something's up from the jay, all of this integrates and is instructions to our body that keeps us safe, essentially, quite literally. And in the case of this story, there's also another story, which is, I know that that's the female jay. I know where her nest is. I know she's raising young. I know she eats the acorns from the live oak tree up over on the hill, and I see her moving them and hiding them in different places, and I see the squirrel watch and then go steal them. And you know, so it isn't even just the immediate sensory impact. It's also that the jay fits into a map of a landscape that's even more informative and more contextualized. That's all sourcing from what my nervous system really expects. And it all makes sense within a greater context. Well, how do you activate that? You know, because ultimately, when you sit in that chair and you watch all the screens at the same time, you can't think if you want to, right? So if I'm going outside and I'm listening to the quietest sound in all the directions around me, and I'm listening for bird language in the distance, and I'm using my peripheral vision to take in the whole scene before me, and then my focus vision is identifying things as I go, recognizing patterns, and my mind is identifying or tagging things as I'm moving, right? My gut feeling's kind of paying attention to the feelings of the bird language around me so I can tell where the danger is for the birds, and maybe that's danger for me too. I need to pay attention. I'm watching for animal tracks and sign and trails, and I'm telling a story and these threads. You know, this set of deer tracks going left to right, my brain is going, oh, that goes right here on the map. And it's like, okay, that looks like the buck. Hey, isn't that cool? He's going that way again, same time of day as yesterday. I wonder why. You know, and then a question is floating out over to the right. You know, so you find yourself looking over to the right. Oh, yeah, the oak tree. Acorns are falling. He's eating acorns, I'll bet. I'll go check that out later. You know, so your brain is just doing all this stuff, but it's all making sense within one process. And if I'm walking and I'm tuning into all of that at the same time and not particularly attached to any of it, my mind, my thinking mind, just falls into this silent place, and once in a while it names things. But it's not running the machine. It's too busy watching all the monitors. And it has a much better role when it's there. It's much more healthy in the way that it's operating. It doesn't create anxiety for me. I'm now at peace with myself. And as I'm moving around, I'm picking up on a lot of patterns and a lot of stuff's going on, but I don't even know what I'm picking up on because I'm not thinking about it as I go along. I'm paying attention through my senses and being in the moment, and I'm appreciating and smelling and seeing and stopping and looking and listening and just feeling. So now I get back to the village, the fire is burning, and here are the people all sitting and waiting. You know, and they're in a circle, and they're all sitting by the fire, and they're all excited because, hey, the hunters came back. They went out there, they were gone for 3 days, but they're back. You know, and there's literally people whose hands are ringing. They can't wait to hear the story from the hunters, right? But the hunters, they've been out of the village, and they know that the women have been breaking into small groups and going out and doing their thing, and they're all coming back, and they have stories too. So the hunters are feeling that way about what the women are going to say, right? And the kids are sitting wide-eyed, and they're looking at everybody, and they're just like, I don't know who to listen to. This is so exciting. But you can literally feel the excitement building in the community for the story of the day. And they know something about the story of the day. And I think this is important for us to recognize, that they know that everybody was looking for the funniest thing possible to tell in their story of the day for tonight, because they have this really, really high level value for comedy, and they love slapstick. So they see sparkles in eyes on the way to the fire. They know that someone's got a really funny story. They're not sure who's going to tell it and what the funny story is, but they're just waiting for the story to come out at the fire tonight. You know, so they, during their storytelling, they're going to recapitulate all of their sensory memories. So they're going to get in the chair within their consciousness, and they're going to access all their screens, and they're going to pull pieces from every screen when they tell their story. They're going to literally relive with every sensory memory they've got and get it in their body, because they kind of rate each other on their ability to do that. So it's not like a judgment, and you're not on the hook to do it or not do it, so you're not bad or good if you did it or didn't do it. But crowd response, you know, it's a lot like rating systems on Amazon. You know, crowd response tells people you're on the right track or not. You know, so the best storytellers get the biggest response, and all the kids grow up looking and realizing the ones who put everything into their storytelling, you know, they're the ones who get the biggest laughs. So everybody wants to imitate that, and everybody places this high value on pulling in as much sensory power into the storytelling as possible when they get around that story at night to tell the story of the day. So you can see, you know, the origin of arts, the origin of what, acting? It's all in this, and we're all hardwired for it. You know, it's not a passive thing, it's an active thing. So when a child comes running in with a story to tell mom or grandma, hey, I was outside in the yard, this little bird was freaking out over here, and then I saw the chipmunk over there, and he was also freaking out, and his tail was going like this, and he was making this sound, and I couldn't stop looking, and then I went over there to look to see what was up, and oh, I saw that snake, you know, and I think it's a rattlesnake, right? So grandma is like, awesome, let's go out and look, you know. But before grandma goes out, she makes him tell the story again. And as he's telling the story, she's imitating his body language. As he's making the body language, she's doing it back to him. They're using the mirror neuron system unconsciously, but it's a very conscious thing, okay? So there's a real deliberate a drop down to this height of the child. And if they're getting excited, then grandmother gets excited. She makes the face that he's making, right? She goes like that when he does. So there's this mirror neuron thing going on, and she's demonstrating that the whole body is what's listening. And so obviously I'm not talking about our grandmas, right? I'm talking about the San Bushmen. I'm doing it in a North American context with chipmunks and rattlesnakes. But still, this is the feedback that's happening. You know, the child is being trained from an early age to put their whole self into storytelling, you see? So when the child comes back, they're listening for certain things. Okay, I hear my grandson, he's talking a lot about what he's seeing, but he never mentions what he's hearing. So now I'm going to start zeroing in all my questions about hearing. So when this grandfather talks to this neighbor grandmother, hey, if you see my son, and he, grandson, if he tells you a story, make him talk about what he hears, not just what he sees. Oh, okay, I noticed that about him too. You know, so there's like collaboration among the elders to expand sensory use and sensory capacity so that all the monitors are coming into focus for the children as they're growing. Now, the story of the day is such a profound opportunity. It's not just a performance opportunity for the individual. It's also an opportunity for the rest of the village to gauge the calibration level of the individual telling the stories. And they always role model the most amazing storytellers. They're not in a contest and auditioning to see who gets to tell stories, but crowdsourcing says who's telling the best stories. And the kids grow up seeing that whole body delivery, that full reliving. You know, as B.B. King said, you know, one of the things that he said was, you know, there's good stories in that music. It's not just a bunch of words strung together with sound. I'm reliving the story. And as you listen, you should relive the story with me, because then you'll really feel the music. You know, it's this idea that it isn't just words coming out of a mouth bouncing off of eardrums. There's more to it than that. You know, and that what we're really working on with the story of the day, especially in young people, is awakening their ability to tell stories from every aspect of their sensory memory. And so all senses. You know, so if we look in kind of a modern way, we associate the east attribute, the east shield, with the eyesight. We associate the southeast attribute, vitality, with proprioception and vestibular activity, where the body is telling the story, right? In the south, we use hearing, listening for the quietest sound. Well, here's a real interesting technique that Tom Brown used with me a lot when I was growing up. When I saw an animal track, my eyes fall into the animal track, I focus 100% on it, my hearing switches off, and I become very mental. So there's almost like a cue between pattern recognition and thought that is like a cable that's already there, right? So he knows that. So as I look down at the track, he says, shh, did you hear that? I'm like, what? He says, keep looking. So I go look back down again, and I'm looking, and he's like, did you hear it? I'm like, the wood thrush? What did you hear? Wood thrush? Good. Then we look back at the track. He doesn't let me fall into my eyes, because eyes are seductive and they pull you into cognitive framing, cognitive analysis. Off goes the listening. Off goes the senses. You get trapped in that part of your brain which is trickster. Anchor it with the ears at the same time the eyes are operating. So he trains you to listen to the quietest sound in the four directions. And then, you know, you're feeling the track with your fingertips. Is it soft? Does it have a crust? Right? If it feels soft like cornstarch, silky, then you know it's really fresh. If it has a crust on it, like a little skin that you can't, your eyes can't see, but your fingers can feel, then you know it's been there for a little while. There's been evaporation. Even if the track looks fresh, it may not be. So even the touch is involved in the story, you know. And then the sense of smell. Oh, yeah, I see it right now. The bear tracks are here, and I can smell the salmon in the river. They're running right now, and I know that's what's happening. The bears are going to the river. I know. I don't even have to go look, because I can smell the river. I can hear the river. I can hear the ravens. I can hear the bald eagles calling. I can smell the salmon. I can feel the freshness of this bear track. I know this bear's going to the river. I can bring that whole thing back through my senses, you see? And when I tell the story of the day, I'm expected to be able to bring all the senses into my storytelling, not just, I saw some bear tracks. I have to have a story. I have to feel the bear. If I'm going to tell a bear story, then I'm going to have to become a bear even for just a moment, right? When the Bushman woman's telling you about the snake, she's doing this as she's talking about a snake. You know, her eyes are going, and she's getting all wild-eyed looking, and her hand's moving like a snake. And then all the kids' eyes are getting big, like, whoa, you know? Right? And as they're talking, they haven't even started to talk about the giraffe. They haven't begun to talk, but their hand is already telling you the giraffe is coming into the story, you know. So they're using one hand as a giraffe and one hand as a snake while they tell you other things. You know, you're just like, whoa, you know. They're bringing everything in when they tell that story, and they're modeling that. And then the children are, you know, through mirror neurons, they're watching that. You know, but the best stories are the funniest ones. You know, so I was a victim of that. Because there was one day when we were walking, it was my first visit to these people. It was my first trip to Africa, and I was carrying a North American field guide in my head. And, you know, snakes with slits for eyeballs, poisonous. Round pupils, might be poisonous, probably not. Look for relationship of head size to neck size and overall shape of snake. Round pupils, okay, it's cool. So as I'm walking with this Bushman hunter named, well, forget it, Kakao. He has two clicks that I can't do. Kakao, never try that, it's close. As I'm walking with him, and he's on one side of the bush and I'm on the other and the translator's walking right behind us, we're coming to a bush, we go around it, and he goes, I know something in his language, I barely hear him, and he points with his hand, but I see his hand point through the bush, and she says, John, Kakao said snake, be careful. Snake? Cool, you know, so I turn and look. Oh, and here comes this beautiful yellow snake about 9 feet long. It's beautiful, right? Yellow. I'm like, wow, that's a cool snake. And I look, and it's got nice round pupils. I'm like, oh. And it's coming right towards me, and it gets about maybe about 5 feet from my face, and it raises up about this far off the ground, and its hood goes poof. And suddenly I'm looking at a Cape Cobra, and I'm like, oh, my God. So what I do is I let out this high-pitched shrieking sound, and I kind of fly up in the air with my hands in this position, kind of like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and I fly through the air, and then I land and fall, you know, a good 15, 20 feet safely away from the snake. And I'm like, whoa, that's a cobra, you know. I didn't notice anything, right? The Bushmen are just kind of walking along, you know, it's the end of the day. Well, that night at the fire, they took turns imitating the whole thing, right? With the perfect imitation of my shriek and the flying through the air, and everybody laughs so hard, right? So that the one person telling that story tells it again and again and again until the laughter doesn't come up anymore. He'll just keep saying the exact same story and going through the whole thing over again, physically imitating it until everyone stops laughing. And then someone else will stand up and imitate him imitating me. And the whole thing will go to another peak, right? And this is what they're doing around the fire at night. You know, they're, do you see how much emphasis is on the value of storytelling, the value of humor? They love slapstick. They find ways to weave it in because then, why? Because it's fun, right? And the laughter goes on late into the night. They laugh, they tell stories, but the whole time they're also really listening to each other, you know, and they're listening for that calibration thing, you know, and it's just such a, the story of the day to me is one of the richest things that these traditional cultures have that, you know what, every single person that gets exposed to it brings it right back. There's not one person who hears about this who doesn't find ways to start incorporating it into everyday conversations. And it's so valuable. It's so valuable. There's no reason not to, right? We have a dear friend in Dublin, Ireland, Jerry Brady, who's a master of these storytelling things. And, you know, I was watching him at the Art of Mentoring in the UK and England, and he was literally using storytelling and humor and pointing at nature and singing songs and using them in combination to basically take deflated people who literally hung from their shoulders and had long, mopey faces, right? He took it upon himself to sit in a chair and watch for people with body language like that, and he would just zoom over to them like a kingfisher over a creek looking for little fish, get himself right in there, grab the hand of a person, put the other hand on the shoulder, and just start talking and pointing and telling stories and laughing. And you're watching these bodies going like this. And the shoulders are back, the faces are smiling, the eyes are twinkling, and then they walk away with a whole quickness in their step, you know? And he just did that for, we counted 175 people at the Art of Mentoring in the UK, one-on-one. Those of you who know Jerry know this is totally possible. He did it over the course of 7 days. But he literally did that for every single person at the Art of Mentoring. You know, and it's the power of humor, it's the power of storytelling, it's the power of song, it's the power of that full sensory reliving and the appreciation of life being modeled. You know, but there's a training ground for it. And the training ground is simply this. People go out, have an experience in nature, they want to come back and tell somebody about it. We need to listen unconditionally, but we need to listen for good things. We need to listen for those moments when they don't tell you about what they hear, only what they see, and ask questions and help expand out the storytelling capability. And then in that way, the capacity increases pretty quickly. And you'd be surprised how many modern people I know who started out kind of hanging from their frame and looking long-faced, who are now incredible storytellers, who delight children and get that sparkle going, and the kids get all electrified from it. You know, I've seen it hundreds of times. You know, we all know that this is true. We all know it's in our bones. We know that when we sit in that chair at the center and we monitor all the panels that are coming in and we're getting sensibility from all of them in the context of this greater mapped landscape and relationship with nature, we've really activated that ancient neurology and we're really waking up the power of the quiet mind. And we're preparing people for a very powerful life when we do it in that way, especially young people. You know, and it's rich, and you will forget, and I will forget, but let's just do our best not to, and we'll see you in the next one. Sound good? All right.